They're cursed. All of them.
Unfortunately, cursed does not give me a warrant to wander about Sir John's estate at night. Rules, Mrs. Kirk. They're all that keep us from a dog-eat-dog world, you know.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
That wasn't good, but I'll go with it.
Trish Coughlin over there.
Hello.
Well done.
I like how you kind of worked it into the howl.
Absolutely.
That was good. So I'm guessing that kind of rolls into something we're going to talk about today.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street, right?
Oh, God.
You want to talk about horror films?
That is 2 hours I want back.
Yeah, the financial world, right?
No. We're going to talk about the universal classic horror movie, The Wolfman from 1941. Mm-hmm. One of the later entries into the universal horror family, actually.
Yes.
They had figured it out by this time, though, I think.
Yeah, the only one that kind of comes out after that, out of the big guns of the horror, universal horror stuff, would be The Creature, which is from the 50s. Most of their big ones, like Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, The Invisible Man, they were all in the 30s.
Yeah,
they were, and this is their first original property for the Universal Monsters, so it makes sense that it came out after. It's like, okay, well, we've got all these great monsters, what do we do next? And it's like, oh, werewolves, there's nothing for werewolves, let's do something.
I think it's great how much of what people know of werewolf mythology comes from this movie where they just made shit up.
Yes.
Like the poem that is repeated over and over and over again in that movie. And
the pentagram.
The pentagram. Yeah. And there's so much. The full moon stuff wouldn't come until later.
Yeah.
Because this one was less reliant on that. It was when the wolfsbane blooms. And so a particular season at night. I think the subsequent films wound up
switching over to the full moon because it gives them more flexibility, because wolfsbane only blooms at certain times of the year, right?
Yeah.
Whereas a full moon happens once every month. So it just it does allow them
different
times.
It makes
it
harder on the person.
Yeah.
Because like the wolfsbane, if it's only blooming certain times, it's like kind of like being a werewolf wouldn't be that bad. It's only a few times a year.
And you plan for it, right?
Exactly.
And fucking don't live where wolfsbane propagates, you know? You'll be fine.
You'd think.
But yeah, they took some of the iconography from this movie and then it spilled over into subsequent sequels. When did you guys like see this as a kid? Like, I am of a certain enough age where a lot of this stuff was in reruns when I was a kid. I'd stay up late to watch these on, I think, CBC at night on a weekend.
I saw it on PBS when I was probably about 10 or 11. Mm. I used to play a lot of classic films on PBS. That's where I discovered Laurel and Hardy, Abbott Costello, all that stuff was on there, and Monty Python. But yeah, this was one of those movies. I think all the Universal Monsters, for the most part, the first viewings were on PBS.
Yeah, it could have been PBS for me as well. I watched quite a bit of PBS.
Yeah, I came pretty late to it, so I didn't get, and we didn't have PBS. So I think sort of I went through like a phase where I was just kind of renting old movies to rent old movies.
Yeah, and I think Jay and I were talking while I was watching it. I'm like, I haven't seen this movie since I was a kid. And I had forgotten how good it really is.
And I just went upstairs and grabbed my DVD.
Nice.
Well, it is werewolves. You might have close to almost every werewolf movie ever made, but
No, that is definitely not true anymore.
No.
Anymore.
No.
Because there have been so many.
There's some you don't want to have.
No, there was a time where I had a few, like when I had my VHS collection, but since I got rid of that, I haven't tried to put all that stuff back together again. No point. But I do love these movies. It's funny because I was looking at my Universal Horror collection. Mm-hmm. Like I have The Wolfman. These are the ones I have. These are the ones that came out when they were doing that Van Helsing movie.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So these collections, and Universal actually had done a werewolf movie before in the 30s called Werewolf of London.
Okay.
But the one that everybody remembers is the Lon Chaney Jr. Wolfman, okay, which is the one we're covering today.
Well, yeah, the one of the reasons it didn't do so very well is because the lead actor didn't want to be under all the makeup.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, I look at this box set, and it's got, you know, The Wolfman, Werewolf of London, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and She-Wolf of London, and then I'm thinking about it, I've only seen two of these.
Yeah.
Like, I still haven't watched all of these movies. So maybe there's going to be a whole bunch of unseen Universals slipping into our 31 Days of Horror.
Maybe, yes.
As we record this, we haven't technically started, but when you listen to this, we will be about a week or so.
Yeah, exactly, over a weekend.
About a week into our 31 Days of Horror, so I'm trying to, in my head, curate. I'm trying to make a big spread of, I want to put a little more classic stuff in there, so I might go really classic and then kind of 70s, 80s, and then there'll be a mix of modern stuff in there as well. I'm going to have a nice big spread. I was even thinking I might, I'll save it. I'll save it for our special. All three of us are going to be watching 31 horror movies we've never seen before over 31 days of October, and that's going to culminate into a special in November.
Yes. Above and beyond what we're doing for the podcast.
So. Yes, and as well as the ongoing horror movies we'll be doing all month long for our regular episodes.
Yeah, a couple of the ones we're doing might sneak into mine because there's a couple I haven't seen in what we've got planned for this month.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always inevitable crossovers. We don't talk to each other about what we're going to be watching. Yep. So,
although sometimes we do inspire each other. Once in a while, we'll see what the other person is watching going, mm-hmm, and check that out because it just sounds so interesting. You can't just pass it up.
Except Trish, who's never on our social media, so she won't see what we're watching.
I won't see what you're
It'll
watching.
All be a surprise
It'll
to her.
It'll all be a surprise. But what I sometimes do is when we do our specials, I'll write down ones I'm like, ooh, and then I might do it the next year if I choose to. Or just wait a couple of years and just see if you guys remember.
And I have been deliberately, because I've been leading up to this, I've been already in the horror mode, but I've been deliberately trying to watch stuff that you guys have already talked about. I'm like, we don't need to talk about that one again. So
and that is just that much harder.
Yeah, just, oh yeah, because it makes it that much.
You're adding an extra level of difficulty.
Yeah, exactly, because there's so much out there. There's no more point in me bringing it up a third time.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, like, there's lots of horror. Like, you can still get 31, even eliminating all that.
I've been making a list all year of things like, oh, that sounds good. Oh, that sounds good. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah. And I'm looking at this list, and I'm like, just this list that I've already made over just this year will keep me going for 31 Days of Horror for the next three or four.
Nice.
Very nice.
And that's not including what's going to come out in the next three or four years.
Yeah. As I keep hearing more and more stuff, I'm like, oh, God. Like, yep. I have done this multiple. We've done, this will be our fourth one for the show, but for me, I'm somewhere in the double digits now, and there's just no end in sight of cool stuff. It's like, how have I not seen this yet?
Yep.
Time.
There's only so much time.
That's why we crunch it all into one month.
That's right. Yeah. And if you do the 31 Days of Horror yourself, please let us know. Share your list. We'll read it on the show. We'll post it on our social media.
Yeah,
we may not have time to read every list, but we will definitely make sure that people see what you did.
We'll pick a couple, two or three maybe for the show, but we'll definitely repost your lists on our social media for everybody to see. Because we
respect
do this
anybody who does it.
If you're following along with this, Meg, all due respect. If nothing else, we'll like, hey, if a whole bunch of you have done it, that it's going to take another episode just to read all your lists.
Yeah.
We'll just read your names of like, holy shit, these guys did it. These guys did it. And check out their full lists. We'll retweet it and we'll maybe direct everybody to your to your social media as well.
And honestly, I was just thinking about this. I wouldn't mind a little note in there telling us when you first started to flag this whole journey. Because there's always a day where you're like, oh, I can't do this anymore.
And then you switch up from horror to horror comedy or vice versa.
Oh, yeah. I've got such a healthy dose in my kind of pre-curated list. So I'm going to have classics and kind of those 70s ones. I've got enough horror comedies that I can at least do one a week. I've got enough horror musicals to do the same.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's going to be an interesting list this year.
Oh, yeah. I want to keep it weird.
I'm going to go some weird stuff. I'm like, it'll be classified as horror, but it's probably going to be some weird shit.
Yeah, so don't miss 31 Days of Horror. We're going to be dropping those episodes early November. Because we actually have to watch the movies. And we're doing it honestly.
Yes. Yeah. And I just want to say that Dean from an IMDb Journey is doing it this year. And if you listen to our guest appearance on their episode, you'll know that they're not big horror fans over there. So I'm interested to see how this works out for Dean.
I'm guessing he's boning up for a rematch.
I think so. And he's got a pretty decent list for somebody who doesn't like horror.
Yeah. All right. I'm looking forward to looking at that. Yeah. I haven't seen his list yet. So
yeah. He threw it out there for people to sort of comment on. Nice. It was a frenzied discussion. I gotta say that.
It'll be interesting to see if he even gets through it. But
somebody actually recommended Audition for him and Cannibal Holocaust. I'm like, he's not ready for those.
No. He needs to be in the kiddie pool first.
Actually, Audition would be great because that will traumatize the shit out of him. Cannibal Holocaust, even I don't want to watch.
No.
But I've never really liked cannibal movies to begin with. I wouldn't give that one to a novice. Audition, I would, because it comes off like a romantic comedy for most of the movie.
Yeah, but I don't think we want to. That's still throwing him in the deep end.
It is throwing him in the deep end.
I also wouldn't have Human Centipede anywhere near him.
Yeah, that wasn't on the list, so we're no concerns there.
Okay, good.
Well, I'll have to take a look at the list and get in on that conversation. I'm guessing it's a bit of weak sauce.
There's some good stuff on there.
Good.
Yeah, and then there's some stuff that
is the Martyrs on there.
No, another one that he's not ready for.
Ready for
no.
No.
Crap, we're supposed to. You keep talking about doing this. I'm not ready for it.
Oh, it's good.
It is very good.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I think I saw part of it, but I'm still not ready for it.
All right. That's enough preamble for 31 Days of Horror. And trust me, you guys are going to love it. If nothing else, do your own. Make it your own. Yeah. You don't have to do something you haven't seen before, but we prefer you did.
Yeah.
If you have seen it before, Don't send us your list, because that's cheating. It's got to be 31 you've never seen before, because let's face it, there's so much cinema in the world. Why watch something you've already rewatched over and over and over again?
Or you might discover a new favorite.
Yeah. Nothing to say you can't watch your favorites, just that you're going to have to start doubling up.
Yeah,
watch some you haven't seen and then watch one of your faves.
Palate cleanser, no harm done.
Yeah, absolutely. There's all sorts of like cool stuff that's premiering this month too. So
yep.
I'm looking forward to it. All right, 1941, The Wolfman, Universal classic, starring Lon Chaney Jr. kind of taking over the horror reins from his father. You know, this I gotta say, like, this is still one of my favorites. There's some stuff that it doesn't age too well to me now. That as I'm older and maybe in a different society these days, and I'm like, you know, Talbot's a little creepy.
Oh. Yes. Oh, yeah. Very stalkerish.
He's a creeper.
Yeah. Well, that, and I don't even think then it really made sense. Like, it's just weird. And what's funny is that I like Lon Chaney Jr. Like, as an actor, like, I've seen him in other films. Mm-hmm. And what carried me through was my love of him, not the character.
To a certain extent, anytime that he's with Gwen there, it's a little skeevy. She's engaged, and he's still kind of pressing the issue, it feels like.
And
he's like, I can win you.
Yeah.
And he's peeping on her in the telescope, and he doesn't think that that's a creepy meet-cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's accidental, but going up and saying, and then being creepy and telling her stuff that nobody should know.
Yeah.
That doesn't come off cute, dude.
No.
Hell no.
No, definitely does not. It did make me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I was like, wow, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah. Like,
and I've seen this movie before.
His less creepy, like, other relationship with the gypsy is better. Like, it's just a less creepy relationship.
Well, and her response to him is very interesting as well, is simply because she is engaged, but she seems very interested in him, and they don't really sort of delve into how it affects her relationship with her fiancé.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if it was more of a marriage of convenience.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking it's not so much convenience. I think it is a small town.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who do you have around that you can marry?
Well, I mean, and her fiancé is kind of in with one of the English lord. And let's not get,
He's not an unattractive man. That's the other part of it, too. For a small town, she's doing pretty good. And he doesn't seem like a dick.
And he has a job.
Can I just point out the elephant in the room on this one? Lon Chaney Jr. is the son of an English lord.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we just let that sink in for a second? Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah, yeah.
is the son of an English lord.
Yep.
There's an irony there, yes.
Yeah.
An English lord who is very tiny.
And only 17 years older than him.
Well, okay, then it technically works, but still.
Yeah, well, they were fairly ambiguous about the time frame, so...
Yeah.
Well, no, they say that
deliberately so,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, he was gone for 18 years.
No, but as far as the era it's presented
yeah.
in, yeah, yeah.
there's an ambiguousness to it. I mean, clothing-wise, it certainly just looks of the era,
yeah.
but I think they deliberately try to say, hey, yeah, we're not going to put a timestamp on this.
Yeah.
yeah.
But yes, he was basically spent his childhood growing up in America, which is why he has no...
No
English
accent.
Accent and all that, and they still did it in the remake.
Yes,
they did, and they did.
My
yeah.
God, damn it! It's even weirder when it's Benicio del Toro.
Yes,
I know. I'm like sitting there going, "It's like, is it just because you can't have a British werewolf?"
At least his mom looked Spanish.
Yes,
yes.
But I don't know. I don't think she ever got to talk, so we won't know for sure.
No, I think the only time that she was on screen was when she died.
Hair. Yeah,
yeah.
But. Like, well, they are definitely staying true to the movie.
Yeah.
In some places, it was like, maybe you shouldn't have.
Yeah.
yeah. We needed more. I'm sorry.
I mean, as much as I appreciate that Benicio del Toro was a huge fan of this movie, and I think he's a fine version of the character of Talbot, but there are certain script changes. I'm like, well, you could just make him English, too.
Yes.
True.
Yeah, they made so many changes to the script, and that's one thing that they could have fixed very easily and then didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to run the trailer for the original Wolfman. There's a lot of music in this one with dialogue near the end, so enjoy some 30s music and a few lines.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
Oh, don't hand me that. You're just wasting your time.
The wolf bit you, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. You wouldn't want to run away with a murderer, would you?
Oh, Larry, you're not. You know you're not.
I killed Bela. I killed Richardson. If I stay here any longer, you can't tell who'll be next.
That was The Wolfman from 1941, written by Kurt Sciatamac. Sciatamac? Sure. That guy. Man, he was a big staple of the 30s, 40s, and even 50s. He wrote things like House of Frankenstein, Son of Dracula, Earth versus the Flying Saucers, Creature with the Atom Brain and Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. Nice. And half of those I kind of want to do for remakes of the show. They all sound awesome.
Yes.
Directed by George Wagner, who also directed Horror Island from 1941. I don't know what it's about, but I like the title.
Yeah.
Another At the very one. Least, it'll be in a trailer go-go.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. Man-Made Monster, also from 1941. I think probably these type of things, because it's amazing that they pumped these movies out as quickly as they did back then. Yeah. But it's those type of movies that probably got them this one.
Oh, yeah.
Makeup for the Wolfman mm-hmm. and special effects was the great Jack Pierce, who did the makeup effects for Frankenstein. By this point, he was a little behind the times on his makeup job, but still looked pretty good. They wanted to avoid those prosthetics that wouldn't move mm-hmm. and would look too good, which is why we had that more closer to the face type stuff, so the makeup would be more expressive.
Yeah, and it does work really well. It stands up like surprisingly well, given the fact that it was mentioned mm-hmm. it was made in 1941.
Yeah, which is also because Del Toro and Rick Baker, the effects man for the remake, wanted to stick to the look of the Wolfman from this movie for the remake.
Yeah, and when you watch the remake, it shows, and it's mm-hmm. really well done, and you can tell there's definitely they kept the general look and feel of the original.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think so, too. Starring Claude Rains as Sir John Talbot, he is most famous for being the Invisible Man. And, of course, he was in a big classic as well called Casablanca. Ever heard of it?
No. Yeah. No, I have to look for that.
Yeah. You should check it out. It's all right.
Casablanca. House of White?
What? Casablanca.
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 Okay.
You good?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, write it down.
Okay.
That's good. Yeah, you should definitely check that one out. It's not bad.
Nice.
Yeah. I hear good things.
Cool.
Warren William was Dr. Lloyd. He starred in a series of movies called The Lone Wolf Somethings that always have a tagline. There's a ton of them. I've never even heard of them, and there's a ton of them, so I kind of want to check it out because there's so many of them. Of course, Lon Chaney Jr. as the titular Wolf Man and Larry Talbot. We have talked about him several times on our show, starting with episode 47.
High Noon.
Episode 60.
I missed some episode 60.
How could you miss Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein?
Oh, I do have that
one. Oh, yeah, but you weren't here for that one.
You weren't here for that one. And episode 171.
1 million BC.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good job, Sam.
And if you count the 30 Days of Horror, he was in Spider Baby, which I did.
Oh, there you go. If I count things I've seen.
I know, but I'm like, I just wanted a deep cut that was mine.
There we go.
Fair. I suck at this game.
Ralph Bellamy was Colonel Paul Montford. I don't think I've ever seen him younger than this.
Yeah, he's always been old to me.
Yeah, it tells you how long his career was when it stretches back here. And then we talked about him in episode 68.
Trading Places?
That's the one. Excellent. Good job. And he's also stars in Pretty Woman, which was probably the bane of my existence in film school because we did continuity class and had to watch that movie over and over and over again. And that movie is, even though it's a romantic comedy classic, is so terribly made.
Do you think that's really kind of contributed to your dislike of romantic comedies?
It certainly didn't help, especially when you start noticing all of the continuity errors. There's like, I think I counted alone myself 150. So
oh my god,
it's redonkulous. So when you pay closer attention to that movie, it's like, oh my god,
yeah, like I'm gonna watch it again.
Thing? I'm never gonna watch it again.
I'll watch it if it's on TV.
I have watched it probably for everybody, more than enough.
It's not my favorite Julia Roberts.
I have taken movie. This bullet for everybody. Patrick Knowles was Frank Andrews. He's in another movie I would like to cover someday, From Earth to the Moon.
Ooh.
Bela Lugosi here is Bella.
Yes.
Under some heavy gypsy makeup, but he plays the gypsy that is a werewolf and bites Larry Talbot.
Before getting his head caved in.
With a silver cane.
Brutally.
Bela Lugosi, we've also talked about before, specifically in episode 72.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
And, of course, we've mentioned Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein from episode 60.
And I did get that one for him. Go figure.
I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, Plan 9 is not on Bella's IMDb page.
Yeah, I saw that too. I'm like, well, I know we've talked about him. I mean, why is this not on here? But
even he after death, he decided he didn't want it.
I think his estate went, no, we're not doing
putting
that.
It on there.
Yeah. Maria Ospenskaya.
Well done.
Yeah, nice, nice.
Was Maliva, and her character would return to the series later on. And I think she was great. This old gypsy wonderful. Lady was pretty awesome. Evelyn Ankers was Gwen Conliff. She was in Ghost of Frankenstein. J.M. Carrigan was Charles Conliff, and he was in another kind of, you may or may not have heard of it, Gone with the Wind.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
Yeah.
It sounds vaguely familiar.
So, you know, it was all downhill after that.
Yeah.
Faye Helm was Jenny Williams. She was in another movie called Night Monster. And Forrester Harvey played Twiddle, who was also in The Invisible Man with Claude Rains.
Nice.
Yeah. When I saw his name, I thought we talked about him before, but I couldn't find
it either.
Yeah, but you had the same feeling, didn't you?
I did. Probably saw whatever the same movie was.
Yeah.
Or it just reminded us of somebody, yeah. I don't know. But I thought I could have sworn, and I'd looked up and down his IMDb page.
Yeah, that's probably where I spent my most time, actually.
I swear!
Well, with these bigger casts, too, like going through and then finding the connections to our older episodes, it takes a couple hours.
And most of these guys have like 170, 200 credits.
Because, they're making four or five movies a year.
Yeah, it's a long slog, and that's probably how I missed Lon in the Abbott and Costello, because, I mean, his body of work is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I just can't forget that one, because it's one of my favorites.
It's so good. It's one of the episodes we need to really make.
Lon Chaney Jr., he makes some interesting choices in this one. Like, he comes off, once he's bitten, he comes off very worrisome. I don't want to say whiny, but it does come off that way sometimes.
It does sometimes, yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Like, but he's fearful in a panicked way about the people around him that he cares about once he's bitten. Once he believes in it, he doesn't believe in it right away. When Maliva pulls him aside and says, yeah, that body they found was the wolf and that was my son.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been bitten. You need to take this charm, amulet. This amulet. It'll keep you from changing. And then first thing he does is give it away to Gwen. Because, hey, jewelry, hot piece of ass. Maybe I can get some.
Not like, if you kill her.
So skeevy, dude.
It really, really, really is. And there's
a magical amulet.
I mean, yeah, it's not that kind of magic.
Yeah.
The magic ain't going to get you laid.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, that magic ain't going to help you there, dude.
You know, this is the amulet called Tinder.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost makes you wonder if there's supposed to be sort of like an allegory there for how America corrupted him.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Right. Because he does come across, and I'm sorry to American fans, there's an unfortunate stereotype about America, about sort of how forward and selfish.
It's a bit Americans of entitlement.
There's an entitlement there that isn't necessarily true.
I think there's a brashness to the character that you may be onto something there. Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, this is 1941.
He is American too, right?
Yeah, this is 1941. Yeah. World War II is just getting going.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see some allegories there as well, that fear of the unknown, of foreign invaders.
Of the future.
Or just the within the superstition of the townspeople as well. It's like, well, here's this guy who's different than us.
Well, and not just that. It's like he is the son of the Lord there, and this guy's here, and it's sort of like just the interloper that's coming in and just taking over.
Well, and I mean, if things didn't move so quickly, I bet you he was going to be would have ruffled some feathers along the way. I mean, here he is hitting on this dude's wife, who's a friend of his father's.
He's an employee of his father's.
Yeah, exactly, an employee of the estate.
Well, his fiance,
but regardless, his actions are morally gray. It's definitely his interactions with Gwen.
I mean, he's drawn back to the estate because of the death of his brother, which we don't really get much more expounded upon.
No, it was just a hunting accident.
And that's something that they have expounded upon in the remake as well. Again, he's drawn back to the family estate because of the death of his brother, but we do get to see what happens. His brother is out being attacked by a werewolf. And the estate's in quite disrepair compared to this one. So yes. As that movie progresses, you kind of get why most of the staff is left, because they're scared shitless.
Well, that, yeah, that or maybe they're dead.
Yeah.
When your staff starts dying, people don't want to work for you.
Well, I wonder if he released a lot of them as well, because he didn't want his secret getting out.
And Sir John certainly kept that secret for quite some time.
Yeah.
And then it became this just weird cover-up. He certainly didn't feel that upset about chewing on his kid.
No.
No, not at all.
Yeah, like, it's sort of, it's weird. Like, it's like the longer he was the wolf, I guess they were trying to say, like, the longer it would have corrupted him. Like, eventually you just become an evil wolf. And it's like, well, wolves aren't inherently evil, so I don't really know where that came from.
Yeah, like, they make it sound like these are joy killings rather than just... And that's something that's always bugged me about werewolf lore, is they just hunt and eat and hunt and eat and attack for malevolent purposes. And I don't think that's always the case. If animals still act as animals. So werewolf movies has kind of bugged me in that regard.
Yeah. Well, there's a moment in the remake that I really, really liked at the end with him and Gwen. Mm-hmm. Right? And they could have done so much with that. And they kind of wasted it.
They did. I hear you on that.
Where she's finally starting to get through to him, and then it comes to the tragic climax. And I think that they could have gone a different direction with that and made it a lot more interesting and humanized the wolf or the wolf man a little bit. Because mm-hmm. they almost got there, and then they dropped the ball.
Well, yeah. I think they were still trying to play with the restraints of the 30s and 40s that were put on them by, I can't remember what the movie body was at the time, but what would be the version of the MPAA now?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Basically said all movie monsters, regardless of motive,
have to die.
Must die. Yeah. So I think the remake was still trying to hold. In some cases, I think they were too precious with some of the rules.
I think so, yeah, because even with all of what happens and everything they did in the remake, it does not feel as tragic as the original.
No, there are certain changes, especially that climax. I was reading that they wound up reshooting that entire climax, and it was edited in such a way to have a faster pace because it was post-Underworld, so they wanted that. And I'm like, no. We had Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula and then Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, and I wanted the Wolfman so bad, and it took so long. I'm like, we need this to complete this trilogy of
the
remakes,
classic horrors,
of these classic horrors in this gothic style, this dark gothic style. And you can see it's there, but it's kind of feels piecemeal. Like, even the Danny Elfman score, like, it's the original score, but it was scored to a movie that had a different pace.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like it fits anymore.
Well, I will be honest, the first time I tried to watch this, it was an abort. I just couldn't get into it. Mm-hmm. Of course, this time I did make it through, and I enjoyed it more than I expected to.
Yeah, it's not horrible, but by no means is it better than the original, that's for sure. Mm-hmm.
They did everything that we ask people to do when they do a remake,
but
somehow they still missed the work.
Well, you can see where lots of changes along the way. You can. Yeah. This is one of those times where you can see producer interference has really screwed up that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also visually gothic, but it's not emotionally gothic.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's the problem.
They were afraid of having that slower pace, but that's what creates your mood.
Mm-hmm. And then I'd find the love story not, it still's fine to me, but it still somewhat comes out of nowhere for me. Because
Well, at least it's a little more subdued.
Oh, I like the one in the remake. He's not pursuing her, and it's sort of they're coming together through shared tragedy, and I get that. It still feels a bit rushed for a gothic movie.
Yeah, Gwen was engaged to his brother, who, of course, died at the beginning of the film. You can maybe feel like there's some interest between the two. But because of that shared family connection, you know, through the brother, this would be inappropriate.
Yeah, there's a great line, actually.
In another lifetime.
Yeah, I wish I'd known you in a different time, No, and I think that's a great line because it says, I have feelings for you, but this is wrong and it's not the time or the place for these types of feelings to be having these feelings.
Yeah.
Or he also knows, he's like, well, now I know what I am. Well, crap, this can't happen now.
Yeah.
Like, that's terrible. He's, like, going to finally realize, and then I didn't do anything when I could.
I love how he sends her away to London, and then he goes to...
Well, he's taken to London.
He's taken to London and put in the asylum. So He's like, damn it. Yeah. But I'm wondering if that was a nod to the original Werewolf in London movie.
It might be the 35. Kind of, yeah, it might have been just to sort of bring in those two original werewolf movies and sort of mash them up just a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, and I sort of like the idea that he was brought to an insane asylum and then you kind of get through that whole movie and you find out, like, he's not really insane, but what he did to overcome a tragedy he witnessed is made what seemed to be something sane happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, this kind of goes to show you about mental health in the Victorian age.
Oh, my God.
Well, we're not going to believe the person who's going through this. We're going to stick you in a room, and when the full moon comes up and nothing happens, we can all laugh at you because there's like a room of a whole bunch of doctors to watch this guy's mental breakdown. I'm like, this is pretty awful regardless of what happens, but... You kind of got this coming. Yep. It does make me wonder who locked the door, though.
Oh, I know, right? Yeah. I'm like going, good on you. I think it was an accident. But the thing about it, too, is like, oh, we have new treatments for your condition. So they inject him with something and lower him into ice water where he can't breathe.
That's not treatment. That's torture.
Yeah.
This is waterboarding.
What are you fucking doing? They go on to the electroshock, which is actually a valid treatment now, but not the way they do it.
Oy. That's just a different kind of horror there.
That was probably the most horrific part of the whole movie, actually.
The movie's quite gory.
It is, and that doesn't surprise me given when it was made, and that's sort of a go-to in these remakes as well. The story's already good, let's gore it up.
When that initial werewolf, like, claws through that guy's head through the mouth. It was like, oh, that was gross. And heads flying.
There was at one point where the wolf pulls out somebody's liver, and I couldn't help but think that that was a nod to Anthony Hopkins.
You might be onto something there.
Because I can definitely tell it was a liver.
Yes.
If there was a bottle of Chianti nearby.
Yeah. I think it was one of the doctors, and the doctor was testing him.
That would have been amazing.
It wouldn't be surprising at all that if they did throw a little bit of a nod in there to his iconic character.
And people like to throw Easter eggs like that into their films. No, so I could see that being completely on purpose.
Yeah. It's unfortunate he didn't bring the same menace to this that he did to Hannibal, though.
There's a certain calmness to that character. They're very different. Yeah. There's certainly just the way he holds his eyes and stuff. Yeah. It's just, he's evil through and through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this one, he came across more like a lunatic than as evil. And maybe that's what they were going for.
He does come off a bit cartoon villain, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And he's so much better than that.
And I thought they were trying to aim for like crazy old hermit dude. Like he's wealthy, but he lives alone and he doesn't like anybody on his property.
I think if they'd
leaned
into that a little bit more, I think it would have worked better.
Well,
I don't think they quite got there.
And make him more feral, like a wolf.
When the townspeople come for him the first time, and then he gets chased off with the guns, and he's like, "Oh yeah, my servant's on the roof with the rifle." No, he's not. He's taken off. But so it was a bluff.
Yeah.
But he does come off as the get off my lawn guy.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that if they'd have leaned into that a lot more, I think he would have been a lot more entertaining.
Yeah.
And that was actually the same scene where a brand new addition to the film, a new character, is added to the film, but not new to Victorian crime lovers. Mm-hmm. Was the addition of Frances Aberline, the lead investigator for the Ripper murders.
Yes. Yes.
Also in this remake, which on paper is a good idea. Like, okay, this guy from Scotland Yard, but he failed to catch that guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know why you would put him on these weird cases, or maybe this is the punishment cases.
Or,
yeah, we're going to send you up to the boonies to investigate animal killings.
Yeah.
See, and I just kept thinking, like, I thought maybe they were introducing something like he's the Fox Mulder of this gothic era. And it's like the Ripper murders was actually like a monster, but nobody believes him.
Well, if they'd have done more with him, I think that would have been great. Like, kind of like the Van Helsing type character, right?
Yeah, well, this felt like a great idea if they had wanted to do the connective universe back then, which, like, I thought it was a really cool idea to use this character not associated with these films as a bridge.
Yeah.
It would have been really cool.
It would have been really cool, especially considering he was bitten and would be turning into a werewolf.
Yeah. Yes. Well, there was a sequel planned, but because this was a huge bomb, that would not happen.
I wonder if as a wolf he'd be looking for Jack the Ripper.
See, you could go so many great places with that.
Yeah.
Or Jack the Ripper is another werewolf and that's how we can find him.
Yeah, there's, like I said, so many opportunities there that, and I mean, this isn't a terrible film, but it's not as good as it could have been.
Yeah, well, their choices to make it a little more action-orientated, I think, work against the film in a lot of ways.
Just like the most recent Mummy as well.
Yeah.
Well, I think also the most recent Mummy focused on the wrong character.
Well, I mean, that dark universe was dead out of the water with that one, but...
It should have been about the Mummy.
And we've discussed it before. Ultimately, that franchise would have been better served if they would have kept it in the Victorian era. Quit trying to be a Marvel movie. Don't make it. Didn't need to be contemporary. You guys did this before. Like, it's not new for you. You're the original Unified Universe. Yeah.
And those Brendan Fraser Mummy movies, I mean, those did okay.
One of the biggest mistakes they made was casting an actor with too much power in the role.
No, I agree. All right, let us get to the 2010 trailer here, and we'll get back to some more Wolfman talk.
It was 25 years ago that my father found him. He was torn to pieces and half-eaten. Whatever did it was big. And buckshot couldn't kill it. After that, my father went home and cast silver bullets. Wouldn't leave the house on a full moon from then on.
Lo and behold, prodigal son returns.
Hello, father.
You've come for the funeral.
What happened?
Your brother's body was found in a ditch.
He'd been torn to pieces. If there's anything you need, please let me know.
I want to know what happened to him.
Francis Abeline, Scotland Yard.
I cannot stress enough the mortal peril you're in.
What kind of animal could have done such a thing?
You're risking your life. Darkness comes for you.
He's been quite seriously injured.
Thank you for staying with me.
Now we know it's still out there.
You were bitten by the beast. You bear his mark now.
You believe in curses. You have to leave.
What are you afraid of?
There are those who doubt the power. Change men into beasts. A beast has come among us.
Terrible things, Lawrence. You've done terrible things. Be strong, son. Be strong.
I am what they say I am. I'm a monster.
I will kill all of you!
Let me help you.
Beast will have its day.
That was the movie trailer for The Wolfman from 2010 with the screenplay by Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote some pretty cool stuff. Seven, Sleepy Hollow, 8mm, and Brain Scan.
Yes, Brain Scan, which we should do someday.
Yeah, it's been on my list for a while.
See, in Sleepy Hollow, they really captured something in that one.
Yeah.
And that just goes back to Jay's point about studio involvement, right?
Yeah. And this is also co-written by David Self, who wrote Road to Perdition, which was a great comic book. And another movie we actually did do on the show, episode 163.
The Haunting.
The Haunting.
Does okay remakes. Not great remakes, but okay remakes.
Yeah.
Watchable remakes.
The Haunting's pretty terrible.
That's fun. It's goofy.
It's watchable. It's dumb watchable.
It is dumb watchable, but if you're going to watch The Haunting, watch the original film. And then The Wonderful Haunting of Hill House on Netflix.
Oh, yes.
Just skip over this and that other one.
Well.
Directed by Joe Johnston, who directed Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, The Rocketeer, Jumanji, and Captain America, The First Avenger.
Huh.
That's a pretty good pedigree.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, as far as the way this movie looks, cinematography is great. The direction's pretty decent. Again, You get a good director, and then you get a lot of production interference, and then you get the fucking mess that kind of this wound up being. The music in this movie was by Danny Elfman, although it was scored to a much different edit, and then they were going to get something a little more contemporary, but it wasn't working, so they went back to his, but he was unavailable to kind of tweak it, so it doesn't work.
It's a mish.
And the special effects were done by Rick Baker, who is no stranger to werewolves.
Yes.
No, he's not. And also, we've talked about him three separate times.
Tell me.
He is uncredited for special effects in My Science Project, episode 142.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost Story, episode 73.
Yeah.
And he also was in King Kong.
Oh, yes, he was. I
for episode
that.
78. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was he in that one again?
He was in the plot pilot, yeah.
Yeah, he was just a pilot.
Yeah. I just wanted to throw that out.
He's actually in this movie as well.
Yes, he is, yeah. And that's why I mentioned him, because he is actually in it aside from doing makeup.
Yeah, but as far as werewolves goes, American Werewolf of London.
Classic.
Yeah, and you can certainly see some of that influence within the transformation of the werewolf within this movie, even though it was a little more computer-generated this go-around, which guess gave him a little more freedom to sit on his ass. But, whereas the original film, even though you would get a lot of that transformation where they'd shoot something and then overlay it and overlay it and overlay it as the progression of the makeup was, this was the only movie where they were did it really subtly with the feet and the hands, and you don't get much happening in the face. So that would happen in later films.
Yes. And I like the way they paid homage to that in this one, in the asylum scene where he's strapped to the chair.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The transformation is almost entirely his feet and his hands.
Yeah.
And oh God, that was so creepy when his hand bends and his fingers are going the wrong direction.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
No, there's definitely there's some great stuff. The gore is great in this movie. The werewolves look pretty good because they look a little closer to the original film. But I think I'd like a good traditional long snout werewolf. I was almost disappointed they didn't do that. But I understood why they did it, because they wanted to homage the look of the original film, where the makeup for that just wasn't available.
Well, and I don't know if it's so much also that the makeup isn't available.
Well, it was
like
available,
if you...
to do it in a way that the audience would buy it.
But I mean, I think with the original one as well, as like having it look, have a partially human face kind of changes your reaction to the Wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
So I think giving it that anthropomorphic feel is just easier to deal with than making it look too wolf-like.
Well, the original Werewolf in London as well, that's even less makeup than that.
Yeah.
In fact, Jack Pierce developed the 1941 for the 35 film, but the actor wanted to have more of his face showing it. Script-wise, it didn't make a lot of sense to not be recognizable as the character. So he had to go back to the drawing board with the plan B, and then he resurrected his plan A for the 1941 film.
Because Lon Chaney Jr. isn't such a prima donna. Because the actor really did not want to be in so much makeup.
No.
In Werewolf of London. So.
Well, which is ironic, considering his dad made a career of being under makeup.
Yeah.
You know, here's this giant of a man. You kind of have to cover him up and hunch him over just to make him unrecognizable, because he's huge.
Yeah, he's a big man.
I think he did play Frankenstein. Who didn't play Frankenstein? Bela Lugosi did, Karloff did, Glenn Strange.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the Universal ones.
Yeah, the only one who didn't was Claude Rains, because he's tiny.
If you put Claude Rains on stilts, he could play Frankenstein.
Well, Robert De Niro played Frankenstein, and he definitely would have been on stilts.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, certainly.
He's not a tall boy.
Yeah.
But you're also putting him next to Kenneth Branagh, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all not a matter of perspective, right?
It is. I'm sure there was a lot of low angles on him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, this movie stars Benicio del Toro as Lawrence Talbot, best known for The Usual Suspects, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Sicario. Mm. Most recently, Anthony Hopkins played Sir John Talbot. As I mentioned before, he was actually in Bram Stoker's Dracula, Thor, and episode 99.
Red Dragon.
Red Dragon, yes, we have talked about him before. I can't believe the cast in this movie, actually. Emily Blunt was Gwen Conliff, best known for Edge of Tomorrow, and most recently A Quiet Place. Who's,
and Mary Poppins
Mary
Returns.
Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins, y'all.
Yeah. Her career really moved forward fast.
It did.
Oh, yeah. The Devil Wears Prada.
To be honest,
a supporting role.
I was actually I couldn't believe it stretched back to 2010, because it feels like her career was so recent.
Yeah. And she was in Sicario with Benicio, too.
She was. Yeah. She was a big player in Sicario.
Yeah. Actually, I think the lead in the original.
Simon Merrills was Ben Talbot, the brother who got killed at the beginning of the movie. And you Spartacus fans would probably better know him as Crassus in that television series. And he was also in the most recent Amazon Good Omens.
Yes.
Gemin Whalen was the maid. She was in Game of Thrones.
Yep.
Mario Marin Bacquaz was the young Lawrence Talbot. And I wanted to mention that because young Ben was played by a young actor who's gone on to pretty big things now, Asa Butterfield, Hugo, Ender's Game. So not bad for a guy who had a really small part in this film. Maliva was played by Geraldine Chaplin,
yes,
the granddaughter of Charlie Chaplin.
Yep.
You've seen her in The Orphanage and Dr. Zhivago. She's had a nice long career herself.
And actually in Chaplin.
She is Chaplin.
Playing her own grandmother.
Yes.
Yeah. I have her signature on my Chaplin poster upstairs.
Oh, sweet.
Along with Robert Downey Jr. and the director, Richard Attenborough.
Nice.
I know. Hugo Weaving was Aberline. I'm sure you guys have seen a couple of his movies. Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, Matrix, V for Vendetta. Just name a little bit.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
And I do have to say, it's really funny that he did not make top billed cast on IMDb. You had to dig deep to find him.
He did. And look how far it took me to get to him.
Yeah.
Nicholas Day was Colonel Montford. David Stern was Mr. Kirk. He was in Dorian Gray and A Knight's Tale. And Art Malik was Singh, and he was in True Lies.
Yes, I was. It took me a while, and then I looked at his eyes, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember him. Like, well, once he didn't have the turban on.
Yeah.
And, like, his hair, you could see, like, kind of that, his receding hairline and his eyes. I was like, oh, yeah, True Lies guy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I loved him. He was great.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he was an underutilized character as well.
Well, there's a lot of big names in small parts. There was another big actor, and I can't remember. It was a cut scene that had to deal with the cane. Max von Sydow.
Yes.
Was the previous owner of the Silver Cane, which doesn't really come into play that much in the film, so I can see why they cut the scene. But another big actor, I'm like, here's a big actor you filmed a scene with that didn't even make the movie.
Yeah. Oh, see, I saw it with him in it. I wonder what I watched.
Oh, you might have seen, like I said, a director's cut. There is a director's cut.
Because, yeah, it is sort of weird where he just shows up.
I watched this on Netflix. So
okay.
This was the probably the original film.
The theatrical release,
because the scene itself is very weird, because he's just some guy on a train and then just decides to leave his cane for Benicio. That's it. Like, it's very weird.
Like, well, he might need it.
Yeah, and like,
yeah.
The cane's not even present throughout most of the film until the final fight scene between him and his father.
Yeah.
Right, and it just happens to be sitting there on the table. Right.
Yeah, because he arrives with it and then sets it down, and then we never really see it again until near the end of the movie.
Yeah.
When his dad grabs it.
I love the way they made it look really close to the original, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, the head of it isn't nearly as pronounced. I always wanted that cane, but just to throw in a corner of my room or something. Like, even as a kid, I wanted to have that cane. I just thought it was so cool. But
it was really cool.
And I do believe even Rick Baker and Benicio del Toro have replicas of it, but theirs are actually silver.
Of course.
Whereas you don't have to show, and it doesn't actually, you just have to tell the audience it's silver.
Yeah.
It's a black and white movie. Nobody's going to know.
Yeah.
Well, it was probably just molded plastic.
It's something about canes, though. I don't know. When I was a kid, there's a couple of movies I'm like, ooh, I'd like a fancy cane.
There's something regal about it, because you can tell, like, every time you see people with canes in those movies, especially Victorian ones, it was a fashion thing rather than you need it.
Especially in the original, because all it does is carry it around.
Yeah, it's just something to carry around. I'm like, how awful is that? Like,
it's awful. Trust me, as somebody who's carried around canes for Halloween costumes and stuff like that, they're a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
It's an accessory.
Yeah.
But if it has a sword in it, then it's worth it.
There is that, isn't there?
Yes, but this movie did not have that.
No, it has a knife in it, a dagger, really.
This movie really goes for more of the thrills rather than the mood that the first one. It's very good about creating mood.
It is. Given how awkward some of the scenes are in terms of, like, the way they're written and the characterization.
Yeah, this is 40s, still early cinema, and it's still a lot of it comes off like they're on stage.
Yeah.
Yep.
At times. Claude Rains was really bad for that in his earlier films, where he'd be, like, backing his actresses into a corner on Invisible Man. It's like, Claude, you're not on stage. Don't get your lead actresses back to the camera.
Yeah. That's not what this is, dude.
And it probably took him a long time to break himself of those stage habits.
Because, it is a learned skill.
Yeah.
everything has to be kind of much smaller because the camera's going to capture it anyway. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a theater, you're trying to reach the back end of the audience.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's still a lot of big boldness to the performances in here as if they are on a stage. That's something I find charming about these movies, and I tend to forgive.
Yeah, but a twiddle is freaking hilarious because he's way, way over the top.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And his name is Twiddle.
Yes.
What the hell? I wonder if it's a nod to it in the remake where they make Lawrence an actor.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Because but what's funny, though, is watching him do...
He's a much braver person than the original version of the character.
Yeah.
I'd say, like, initially he is, too, in the original film, because he does go after the werewolf and shoot at it. But after that, he's pretty fearful of everybody around him, of maybe hurting them and whatnot.
Well, something about... There's something in the original that...
Benicio's not like that, though.
No, yeah. Not at all. But I think there's something in the original, and I wanted to see how you guys thought about it, actually, is you kind of get the impression that Lawrence is pretty insecure in everything. When he's fixing the telescope for his father, he has that bit of dialogue where he says, well, yeah, I did this for a little while, I did this for a little while, I did this for a little while. It's like he's lost.
Yeah, he doesn't have confidence in himself, or yeah, he's just meandering through life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I got the impression that because he was the second-born son, there was no... Like, I got the impression he was the second-born son in the original one.
Oh, for sure.
And because he was the second-born, there was no... Like, he wasn't really going to get anything. There was no...
He didn't even inherit the title or the inherit
titles or anything. Yeah,
now that,
so there's
now
nothing
that
coming his way.
Yeah, now that his brother's gone, suddenly the importance of the estate, he's going to be the next heir to the estate. It doesn't come off as well as maybe it should because Claude Rains isn't that much older.
Yeah, but that's part of it, yeah.
So it's, like, unconvincing to me. Like, well, it's going to take a while for you to get your inheritance unless you murder this guy. He's pretty young.
He is pretty young. And, I mean, I might be mixing the movies up at this point. But at one point, there's some dialogue about how he's not prepared to be the heir. And that's part of why he has to come home, is to learn responsibilities.
Yeah.
Right. And I believe that's in the first one.
That is, yeah. I mean, like, look at the state of the estate in the second one.
Oh, yeah.
In the remake. There really isn't an estate left.
There's at one point I'm looking and Anthony Hopkins is on the stairs, and it was jarring when I first noticed. I'm like, okay, so I'm watching Anthony Hopkins, but then there's like spider webs and cobwebs all around that staircase where he's standing delivering his lines. I'm like, oh yeah, that place is a dump.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's beautifully done in context with the story, the fact that they added those little elements about this estate in decline because of these things that you don't know are happening yet, right, with the fact that Lord Talbot is a lycanthrope and has been for a long time. So he's not able to keep staff on hand, or he's chosen not to for a very good reason. I mean, the only one who knows the secret is Sing.
But then, like, his son is going to leave with his new wife, so of course he has to die, which is weird.
Especially, yeah, because it would make sense to let him go because it just helped keep your secret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And there's a bit of a flaw in the storytelling.
I got the feeling that Sir John was also into Gwen.
Yes.
There was a jealousy there.
Especially in that dinner scene.
Yeah.
Where she kind of talks with Lawrence before she really talks to him, and he gets really pissy about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when he's explaining things to Lawrence, and he's kind of like explaining that he doesn't want Gwen to go away. He could care less about his son. It's Gwen he doesn't want to go away.
Yeah.
He talks about how she was brought into the household.
She reminds me of your mother.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it that brings in the whole creepy, skeevy element that we got from Lawrence from the first one, I guess.
Yeah. Right. There's some portion in this movie I really did like, the nightmare scene.
Yes.
Yes.
That I quite enjoyed, the psychosis of being a werewolf that comes with that, and the nightmarish dreams. And some of that got clipped. I guess it was even scarier.
Yeah.
Well, and there's actually the earlier part after he gets bitten and he's just healing in the bed and she's looking after him. It's very dreamlike and sort of really, like, there's the nuance there that I really appreciate. Like, it's kind of, this is what I wanted, where it was that slow burn where they have feelings for each other, and it just, I love that part.
Yeah, that really shows how talented the director is, and you can sort of see what he was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
before it got turned into this sort of pseudo action film.
Yeah.
It turned into Van Helsing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's that was a problem. They did an about face midway through the film, and boy, did it damage the movie. It's almost like Universal forgot how to do this. And I get it. They're nervous about putting this kind of money into a big movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the original movie was a mere $180,000. I mean, granted, 1941 movie, so by 2019 standards, that's a little over $3 million. Still really low budget.
Yeah.
You know, they were cranking these out on the cheap. This movie cost, this remake, was $150 million.
Mm-hmm.
It grossed $139 million.
But
yeah, I did wind up recouping another $27 million in DVD and Blu-ray sales, so it wound up kind of getting its budget. But when you think of a movie this big and the marketing involved for it, it's still a huge loss.
Yeah. A huge loss.
I have a question for both of you. At the end, like when we talk about the fight scene, and it turns into a different movie. Did you get at all? I was so furious when how he dies is he gets thrown into a fire and then his head gets clopped off by like Lawrence.
And that was like the third time we saw somebody's head get batted off.
Yeah, it was kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah.
It was like it should have been some silver-based death, as far as I knew.
Well, and they foreshadowed,
especially with the cane being just laying there.
Yeah, yes. And that's what I was expecting. And I mean, they kind of foreshadowed that fire was going to be a part of that death because they started the fire in the home and stuff like that. So you're kind of expecting it, but I think they would have served it better if they had given you that MacGuffin and then had him die by the knife that you didn't even know was in the cane.
Yeah. Then, you know, that's the thing. They don't foreshadow the things they should. And other times it's like, well, clearly you didn't know how to do this because here's Abilene sitting in a bar waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, it's a dog-eat-dog world.
Yeah.
He's basically telling you there's two werewolves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think also because I'm looking at, like, fire I associate with Frankenstein movies, not with werewolf movies.
Well, there's that, too.
Unless the werewolf's fighting Frankenstein.
Yeah. Unless Frankenstein's in the movie, then sure, let's keep it. But if it's two werewolves, no.
No.
No, I think it would have been a great misdirect.
Yeah.
Right? Because I felt like that's what they were doing, was they're setting you up for the misdirect. Mm-hmm. And then they followed through with it. And the thing is, he didn't even go into the fire they'd started. He ended up in the actual fireplace.
Yes.
Yes.
Ah.
Yes, as the rest of the building is burning around them.
Yeah, it was clumsy.
Oh, and did you also notice how fast Gwen can move when she really wants to? Because she kind of gets out of his way, like from out of his arm's reach. And then she's out the door and she's far away from the house.
Hey, well,
in a very short period.
Emily Blunt is pretty healthy.
She is, but I'm like,
it's probably hard to move in those Victorian dresses.
I'm about to say, like, she's in a huge Victorian dress with a corset. There's no way she can move that fast. Even if she is Emily Blunt and she's in shape.
Yeah, that's one of those things that you're supposed to ignore in film, is how quickly things move, especially in horror films. I mean, look at Jason and Michael and all of our slasher killers, right?
Yes.
Somehow they always seem to be in the right place at the right time.
Despite moving at a snail's pace.
Yes.
Well, that's why you watch Behind the Mask. Because they answer that question.
Yes, I do love that. You got to really pump up your cardio because as soon as they look away, you got to boot it.
Well, and not just that. He's like going, okay, so I'm going to beat you to that tree and I'm going to walk and you're going to run. And when she's running and not looking at him, he's running.
Yeah.
And when she looks back, he's walking. And when she's looking, not looking at him, he's running. That's how you do it. And the guys are like, he's cheating. I'm like, well, that's just how you do it. How do you think you do it?
But that's one of those wonderful things that you're not supposed to know about in film.
True.
It's hard work being a creepy movie slasher.
It is. But, you know, I really thought that they could have leaned into this love story a little bit more. It was getting somewhere at a certain point.
Well, I mean, it does come off cheesy because he can only be released by someone who loves him.
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't need that.
So they can create this love without them actually. You could tell there's an unrequited love for each other.
Yeah. A burgeoning love, I think, is more of it, yeah.
Hey, I could have released him just fine, and I didn't give two shits about him.
Yeah.
Well, you give me that gun with a silver bullet, no problem. I'll do it.
I was wondering about that, and I thought it would have been funny is if he used the silver and killed his father. It's like, can you only be released like somebody who loves you? And he's like, oh yeah, I didn't really love you. Damn it.
Well, that part of the prophecy ain't true.
That would be so funny. He's like going, wait, you didn't love me? And that just becomes a whole thing.
And then we're moving into horror comedy, and I love it.
Yeah. I was telling Jason before you got here, Sam, where it's like, I like Benicio del Toro in this role, but his face confuses me because there's so many times where he looks very youthful, and then there's like, in the next shot, he looks 1,000 years old. I don't know how they do it. That is
Benicio del Toro.
It is.
It is just Benicio del Toro.
Defies comprehension, but in the best way.
Yeah. I mean,
he's a challenge for the lighting guy.
He is. He's got
cinematographers must hate him.
Yeah. He's got this unique face. I mean, even in Usual Suspects, he looks older.
But then there's bits where he looks younger.
Yeah.
And then there's bits like he's like super handsome. And then there's other bits where it's like, oh no. Like,
remember that James Bond movie in?
Yeah.
Yeah. That movie, he's always young, but he really was really young.
He was really young. He was damn young.
Young enough, they weren't willing to give him lines.
Yep.
There's always somebody, a Bond villain with no lines.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. His face just is fascinating to me.
It is. And yeah, that is just Benicio del Toro.
Cool. Okay. Just wondering if you guys felt the same way.
No, I did notice that though.
I didn't because I'm so used to seeing it.
It's one of those things that it takes somebody like Trish to like, hey,
I guess
this needs to be said out loud.
It has to be said because it was just jarring to me a couple times. Like, wait, he looks like 30 there. Like, oh no, he looks much older there.
Going back to my Pretty Woman statement about continuity errors, Sam noticed a big one in the original film.
Oh my goodness, and I forgot to write it down. Okay, first time Lon changes into the Wolfman, he is wearing a white shirt and a tie.
And it's a short, like tank top shirt because he's taken off his overshirt.
That's right. He wakes up, or as soon as he changes, he's wearing a black button-down shirt with a shit ton of buttons on the sleeves.
Yeah, a long-sleeve shirt.
It's a long-sleeve shirt, and it's four buttons at the cuff. I counted.
You're obsessed with that cuff.
And then when he wakes up, he's still wearing the black shirt.
Yeah.
Right? And it happens again later on in the movie. It's like every time he changes into the werewolf, he's wearing this black shirt.
There's a cut scene somewhere where he's transformed. He's like, oh, I can't go out like this.
Yeah.
He's like, a white tank top will not do.
No, this is going to show way too much blood.
He's like, no, I think he just thinks like, I will look cheap. And just like, I don't want to look like a harlot. I want to look classy as a werewolf.
I am a classy wolf man when I murder you.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's like they sort of built the body part of the costume out with this black shirt.
Yeah.
Completely forgetting that they'd have to count for it somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but as soon as I saw it, I'm like, ooh, continuity wasn't a thing in the 40s, was it?
Nobody of all
time. I just keep imagining, like, he takes off the other shirt, and how he rips the new one is he just can't get his hands through the sleeves. So that's just how he rips it eventually.
I'm wondering how he did the cuffs up.
Yeah, four
with
buttons.
Those claws.
I don't know. Maybe he's just, like, it's like having long fingernails. You just kind of get used to it.
I guess. Yes.
But he hasn't had a chance. This is his first transformation.
We don't know what he does in his spare time. Maybe he likes to have long nails and dress up a little bit.
Oh, now we're looking at some Ed Wood stuff.
Yeah. We don't know. We don't know what he's been doing in America. He said he's been doing this and that.
Yes, and he could be doing some of that.
Yeah. He was really interested in those earrings. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, there's a point there, too.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Just own up to it, Lon. That's all I'm saying. Be proud of who you
are. You be you.
Yeah. Oh my god, a drag werewolf. That would be awesome. Like a werewolf that like just gets dolled up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the remake, it had some great visuals going for it, but unfortunately it felt like a mess. I mean, and you can tell it got messed with. I mean, it was sitting on a shelf for 2 years before they finally released the damn thing. So yeah, it was actually completed in 2008.
Yeah. It had a bit of an identity crisis.
Yeah.
I think probably part of why it sat on the shelf is they were doing edit after edit because they couldn't make it into a cohesive piece of film.
Yeah.
Because the two people, there was two bodies fighting over it and trying to make it what they want.
They were bound and determined to give it a good release date. I think it started in December, and then they moved it to February, and then they moved it to back into like November, and then it moved again an entire year back into the Christmas season. So they didn't want to bury it.
No.
Well, they spent a lot of money on it.
They certainly did.
Yeah. Yeah, and sort of it's, you know, you're in trouble when you have to keep moving it. Because you just never know where
it's
at.
When you start hearing about stuff like that, and it's even more prevalent today when you hear about a movie that's been shelved and moved and whatnot, and you just get more and more worried about it.
I know.
And sometimes it just comes up to studio sales and things like that, where release dates get shuffled because whatever the new entity that takes over has to figure it out.
Yeah.
But in this case, it was Universal's not going anywhere, so...
Yeah. No. Well, it's tough. It, like, the performances I enjoyed in this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, the performances overall I really enjoyed.
Yeah, so. I think it's a great cast. I would have, like I said, I would have liked to have just stuck with that Victorian theme that was already running through the Bram Stoker's Dracula and the Frankenstein one they did afterwards.
Yeah.
I think that would have worked really well for it. And you can certainly see a lot of those elements there. I mean, the cinematography is fantastic. There's some really great visuals in this
movie. There are. I think you're right. I think they should have really leaned into the gothic feel of it versus the Hollywood action feel that we ended up with.
Yeah, we already had Underworld, so we didn't need you to do that with something we already liked. And that was the failing of The Mummy, so clearly... A decade afterwards, they haven't learned their fucking lesson.
That's not what audiences want from these classic monsters.
It's true, and it's sort of, it's funny. It's like the studio hasn't learned that we are capable of handling the tragic ending of someone we love on film. Like, the tragic character of this is what they totally didn't want to do. Like, it's sort of like, just, they seem to like pull back at any given moment on that.
Mm-hmm.
But like, lean into the tragedy. This is a tragic character. Just do it.
Well, that was part of the problem too, is there's no real character development anywhere. Benicio comes off fairly stiff throughout the movie for a very great actor. He doesn't get into those panicked, worrisome modes. His worried face is pretty much his serious face and his horny face.
Well, it's not until he gets to the asylum.
Yeah.
And then he's in a different movie at that point.
Yeah, and even then he's like warning everybody, you don't want to do this. Like when he's in the chair in the room, like, I'm going to kill you all.
Yeah.
And it comes off more like a threat than like, no, this is fact. Like, I'm going to transform and you're going to be my lunch. Although when he says he's going to throw that one guy out the window, and then he does.
Yeah. I love that. But there's at one point, it seems like this line is just completely stepped over. He's like, says, please kill me. And it just, it doesn't get the moment it needs.
No, it was actually more effective in our last episode, Monster Squad.
Yeah, go figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The comedy.
Yeah. But yeah, like John Grease was really, came across as a tragic vampire.
He was so tormented by his state.
Yeah.
Probably the one good thing about this, at least for Rick Baker, is if you're going to do makeup, Wolfman makeup on a human being, do it on a naturally hairy one like Benicio del Toro.
Well, there you go.
Makes your job a whole lot easier. A whole lot less yak hair that needs to be applied.
Yes.
I wasn't familiar with his hairiness. This is new information to me.
I did not know that Benicio was hirsute.
How's Anthony Hopkins doing in that? Like, is he hairy?
I didn't read anything about Anthony.
You didn't read anything about his hairiness?
I have a feeling he didn't really get a whole lot of makeup time. I'm sure that was I'm sure that was a completely different dude.
Yes.
You know what? He didn't get a whole lot of makeup time, but there is one point in the movie where I was looking at it, and it looks like he is drowning in makeup. Like, he just got off stage doing Shakespeare and didn't have time to wipe his face. Like, he's got eyeliner to beat hell.
Well, yeah.
It was really jarring. I'm like, ooh, how much? Like, it just looks like he was just getting ready to go out for the night, you know?
Is there something we don't know about Anthony now, too?
No. I think he just got double booked. He was doing a play and then got back to the set.
I do hate it when I notice the stage makeup.
Yeah.
Like, it happens. The first three or four seasons of Smallville.
Yeah.
Bloody lipstick was driving me up the fucking wall.
What I love is going back to like 90s TV shows and movies and seeing that dark lipstick with the liner. Wow, what were we thinking?
Yeah
Especially as they sort of convert them to HD, it's just that much more noticeable.
Yeah,
right, now that we have HD, they can get away with a really natural look, whereas for 80s and 90s television, it was just to make sure that you could see features, right?
Yeah.
Features now, and flat, limp hair, but you'd have it in spiky hairdos.
Yeah, now you can't do that anymore because we will see it.
Yeah.
Yes, we will see everything.
As we do.
I was watching a Universal Horror documentary about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and there's a couple of different versions where they did a one-take transformation. So it kind of leaves you like, well, wait a minute, his whole face color changes. How did they do that? And it was really simple tricks. You're dealing with black and white. So say you would do the makeup in red. So if you did that and you had a red filter, it would go away. And then you'd lift the red filter, and then suddenly all this makeup pops up. It's crazy.
That is genius.
Yeah, it's very so simple. Yeah. But it's like, it's very super effective. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, there's stuff like in some of those really old movies, even silent films. Like, how the fuck did they do that? Because, you know, you've got this big sci-fi city and metropolis and things flying around. And
oh, some like, German expressionism stuff. I'm like, you guys are crazy.
And they're literally,
amazing.
That's just sliding glass on the lens and things like that.
Well, there's sliding glass and how they built sets that really are off kilter. Mm-hmm. But are built just to appear that way.
Mm-hmm. The things that they did that just out of pure inventiveness, it's like, well, we don't know, we can't, so let's do it.
Yeah. And that is the beauty of filmmaking in general, is they're always looking for better ways to give you the most realistic visual experience they can.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think they tried. I mean, these Universal Monsters movies, these original movies, I think it's sometimes forgotten at how good these movies really are. Mm. Like, these were big movies for this company. And keep in mind, before these movies started and really took off, like Dracula and stuff, like, they were a B company.
Yeah.
You know, always struggling financially. And then came along these horror movies, which is a big risk. Will audience even be able to buy this? And sure enough, they certainly did.
To this day, people wanted horror. Yeah. Like, they responded to horror. They've been responding to horror since the beginning of film.
And yeah, that's something I wanted to mention too while I was watching the original, is while I don't find the original scary per se, as I was watching, I'm like, oh, I can see how a 1940s audience would be really uncomfortable with this, right? Because it's so well told, and everything sort of happens off screen or in shadow, so you can't see what's happening. Mm-hmm. But it's actually more disturbing to see it that way than in the more graphic version that we see in the remake. Because your imagination is so powerful.
And they were so good at showmanship, too. Like, it wasn't just a trip to the theater, but they'd see the audience with somebody who'd leave the audience screaming. That old-timey stuff that they just don't do anymore. Yeah. And I think that's fantastic, because it gets around.
It does get around, yeah.
This movie's really scary.
Yeah.
No, it's not. Well, maybe back then it was, because they had never seen anything like that before.
Well, there's the scene when Talbot gets bit by the werewolf and kills it, when you see him behind the tree sort of and just raising and lowering that cane.
Yeah.
That was actually uncomfortable.
Yeah, because this is a really vicious scene, and it's amazing that stayed in.
Yeah.
And when he kind of grabs that dog, it's a real dog, like on the other side of the tree, before he starts beating.
Yeah.
It's just like, you can see he's grabbing a real dog. I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, well, a different era. We'll leave it at that. But I was surprised that the first werewolf looked more wolf-like. And it does make you wonder if the longer they've been a wolf, the more wolf-like they become.
Oh. And that would be an interesting thing to investigate or to delve into.
Because I thought it was a little weird. It's like, well, you've established this other werewolf as being very wolf-like. Mm. And then here's this very human-looking werewolf in Talbot.
Do you think that Anthony Hopkins like going crazier the longer he was a wolf was a nod to that, because they sort of misinterpreted that sort of idea?
And possibly, because that was something that was kind of vague, is how much was the wolf affecting him. And that could be exactly it, is the more you give into the wolf, the more wolf-like you become, right down to how far you transform into a wolf.
Or maybe the more crazy you start out, the more crazy you become as a wolf, because it just gives you the freedom to just let your crazy out. Because I think if you're a decent dude, you still will be a little crazy as a wolf, but not nearly as crazy as Anthony Hopkins.
No, he was fully embraced the feralness of his wolf.
Wait, oh no, that was Jack Nicholson. I was thinking of Wolf.
Yes, with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah. which I quite liked, actually.
Yeah.
And they did that more subdued makeup in that one as
well. Yeah. Well, it was an interesting allegory. Like, it's like sort of the middle-aged guy, and then it's sort of the wolf is, it's a reclaiming his power type of deal.
Yeah.
But then she gets bit, and then she's badass.
It's been a long time since I've seen that one.
Yeah, I remember really liking it. It's been a while since I saw it, too.
Yeah. James Spader's in it, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
The younger guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone want to take a stab at what the IMDb rating for the original film was?
6.3.
7.3. Damn it.
I part of it, right?
Yeah, so pretty good. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a whopping 94% with an 80% audience score. So, I mean, again, highly regarded. I think a lot of that's nostalgia, but...
You know what? If I completely grade it on the old Gypsy's performance, I'd really give it that.
Yeah, it's a very enjoyable watch, despite its faults that have come through time.
Yeah.
And just not aging as well as some other movies of its time. But still think it's great. Still better than the remake. The remake, any guesses at the IMDb rating?
I can't. I already know.
Oh,
okay. 5.4?
You're very close. 5.8 out of 10.
Sweet. Yeah, I'm getting better at this game.
Yeah, middle grade. Now, Rotten Tomatoes. Let's play that game.
Oh, my God. Okay, Rotten Tomatoes.
Critic score.
I don't know.
They're pretty close, so.
Okay, so 55?
No, I meant like as far as audience and critics.
I'm going to go like 38%. And critics?
Okay, yeah, I've got to go lower. So 42?
All right. The critic score was 35% with a 33% audience score.
Oh, wow. Sam's better at this game. You're great, Sam.
You know, I've been spending a lot of time doing research lately, so I'm seeing more of it and getting a better idea as to sort of how the audience is rating
things. IMDb Price is Right. We got to do this more often.
Yeah.
Got to get better at it.
I think the IMDb is a little closer to, I think, being accurate. I think the Rotten Tomatoes a wee bit too harsh because there's still some enjoyable parts of this movie, but overall it's just a Frankenstein movie instead of a werewolf one.
Yeah, yeah, that's a surprisingly good analogy for it, actually.
Which is a shame when you got somebody like Rick Baker and Benicio del Toro, who are huge fans. Yeah. Like, they collect the Wolfman memorabilia. So for this one to fail so spectacularly must have been quite crushing to them.
Yeah. Well, you can see him trying to embody the tragedy of this character the entire time. Like, I could see him, like, he is very subdued in his performance, but he's trying to do something there.
He does come off more heroic, regardless of when he loses control as the werewolf. You're supposed to believe him as a heroic character instead of a tragic one, which is ultimately...
The biggest failing of the movie, actually.
Yeah, and that was more the point of the original film, is here's this tragic character who had a heroic moment and paid the ultimate price for it.
Yeah, he was a hero and got screwed.
Yeah, and he was haunted by the death of that gypsy, Bela Lugosi.
Well, he was also haunted, I think he's also kind of upset, to a lesser extent, but to somewhat extent, of the death of the other woman, because he didn't save her. She died.
Yeah, that's true.
They make a point of really hammering that home, too, is that that at least some of the villagers are holding him accountable for it.
Because she went out with them to see the gypsy. And I think they're holding him accountable because Gwen didn't want to go alone with him.
Yeah, and then they left her alone so they could go off and canoodle.
That pissed me off.
Jenny's mom there, who was really accusatory.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'd be pissed off, too.
As a parent, you can sort of see how she would want to.
Sure.
Or how she would. She needs somebody to blame.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. She knew that they left her alone with the gypsy, and then she was just walking by herself. So, yeah, I'd be pissed, too.
You kind of like how panicked she was about her reading, though. That was part of it. They just went to, the gypsies are in town. This is something you do.
Yeah,
you go get your fortune read. The aborted reading from Bella as he notices the star, he's like, oh shit, I'm going to wind up murdering this girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He won't tell her, and so she gets more panicked about it. I'm like, all right, take it easy.
I know. Yeah, just tell her to go really far away right away immediately.
Yeah. I thought I was a little overdramatic, but...
Oh, and I think I wrote down one of my notes. I'm like going, oh, so when you ask, when will I get married, and they freak out, it just means you're going to die, not just never get married.
Ironically, they remember when they went to the gypsy camp thinking it was the dancing bear.
Yes.
There's a lot more hatred for the gypsies in the remake. Like, in the original, it's sort of, they're not too friendly with them, but people are like, the gypsies come every year, and we go get our
fortunes. Was kind of accurate, though. Like,
true.
Prejudice existed in
but
every age.
But I was
age.
Surprised in the 41 one, I thought it would have been more prejudicial than it was in the remake, which is strange.
Yeah, and the prejudice doesn't really show up until there's for that discussion between the mother and the priest. Mm-hmm. And that's the only time you sort of see any prejudice at all. It's like, well, you're pagan rituals and stuff.
Oh, yeah. He's like, talk about superstition. And I'm like, superstition? Dude, you're a Catholic priest. You think if you don't go every day or say you're sorry about something, you're going to go to hell. What the hell?
That's also the same as being Canadian.
Yeah. And
you're eating your savior, apparently, so just go with that.
Yeah. And I think the gypsies were underutilized in the remake as well.
Yeah.
I think that they should have been the carrier of the myth a little bit more.
Yeah, well, they make a big presentation of their caravan and the little circus that they put on, but ultimately that's all there just so the werewolf can run amok within it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's just a big slaughterhouse.
Yeah, and it's obviously a nod to the gypsies in the original, but they could have been used to better effect.
Yeah, whereas the gypsies, I think they knew Bella was a werewolf.
Lon.
No,
or Bella was a werewolf. Yeah.
Bella was a werewolf. Once they knew about Lon, well, we know to take care of our own, but...
you're not one of us.
Yeah, you're not one of us, and they took the hell off.
Yeah.
Except for
yeah.
Maliva, who felt some sort of responsibility.
Well, I think it was her son that
did it.
It
was her son, yeah.
So she's like, well, he passed the curse on you, so I'm kind of responsible.
Yeah. All right, well, any last thoughts about the Wolfman from 41 or 2010?
You know, I was jokingly going, oh, I'm dreading this one because I had aborted the 2010 the first time I tried to watch it. And in rewatching or reattempting it, I enjoyed it more than I recall. Maybe I was just in the wrong frame of mind for that early sort of gothic horror part of it for the first half, because I never made it to the second half.
I remember, it's not a movie that stuck in my head. I'd only seen it once before, but I do remember, how much they did pull from the original film that I was kind of surprised, because unlike Frankenstein and Dracula, it didn't have classic literature to fall back on.
No, and it left itself open to maybe more in reinterpretation than it should have gotten.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what did in this film in the end.
Yeah, they sought to tell some of the story that wasn't told in the original, but there were some bits about it that we definitely wanted told, and they just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They added some stuff that we didn't kind of need, and then there was other stuff that we wanted, and they didn't put in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd much rather have seen what probably would have been the longer, more gothic cut of this film that was originally intended. I think it ultimately would have been a more fondly remembered movie
and
because
I
of it.
Don't need the Jack the Ripper investigator.
I thought it was
an, you could have cut him out completely.
I thought it was an interesting idea, but ultimately pointless.
Yeah,
I mean,
it didn't
they
go
just,
anywhere.
Well, they used him to replace Colonel Montford, who was in the movie, so he got pretty much almost cut out. I almost forgot he was there half the time.
Mm-hmm.
Was From Hell around that time, too?
No, From Hell is like 98.
Was it that long ago?
It's a long time ago.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, so I don't know what they're thinking of what was putting in Aberline, other than people would recognize the name. And I'm like, when they brought it up, I'm like, I'm hoping this is just some dude with the same name.
Yeah.
Like, Scotland Yard. I'm like, oh, it's going to be the Ripper. Yeah. And then they drop the Ripper case. I'm like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah.
Like, it was one of those things. I'm like, well, this could work, but it doesn't. Like, you had to tread pretty lightly to make that one work, I think.
Well, and I mean, like, I could buy a Scotland Yard person coming out,
at least
just a different person.
At least if they'd set it up, we've made a call to Scotland Yard, because there's so many murders, such carnage at the beginning of the film at the caravan that, okay, it makes sense he would show up, but, you know, why did it have to be that particular guy?
Well, why would it be Scotland Yard? I mean, these are animal attacks.
Well, I would...
Right? You'd think it would be, like, the military or something like that, somebody who's more qualified to hunt animals.
Well, and I was thinking, like, you could have Scotland Yard come out, because they are floating the idea that it's just some lunatic who's doing this to make it look like an animal attack.
Well, maybe initially you don't send out your guard right away. You go, like, send a guy who can bring back the facts. Like, well, what's happening there? What do we actually need?
Or some Scotland Yard like forensic guy for the time. Like, yeah, we've asked for a Scotland Yard forensic guy to actually investigate what he thinks killed them.
Well, there were no forensics, but there have been the closest. The birth of forensics would have been really happening around the Ripper case.
Yeah.
That's sort of what I'm thinking.
Maybe where they brought him in, but they could have expanded upon that, explaining what that was, why he was brought in.
Yeah.
Because he's the guy familiar with these sort of mutilation cases.
It would have been better if this happened before the Ripper murders, and then he goes back to London.
Ooh, there we go.
He's investigating himself, and he's the Ripper.
But there,
that would be really cool.
Kind of precise, though.
They were, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a different thing.
But it would have been. It still would have been fun.
It still would have been good. But I put him as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of deal, where Hyde is the Ripper because he is a doctor.
See, and now we're creating the whole new Universal Studios monsters.
We can't help but remake stuff.
We were trying to make something better out of crap, so. Yeah.
It's a default setting now.
It is now. When we see something shitty, we got to try to make it better.
Yes. But see, you're creating those ties, right?
Yeah. It's an addiction.
Yeah. That's what I wanted out of the Dark Universe to begin with. I'm like, I didn't want a modern setting with some secret organization that was going to make the Monster Avengers. That was complete bullshit. It was just pissing me off. Like, I wanted a unified universe that came out of Bram Stoker's Dracula and Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein. That world, like, that's where your universal monsters lie, and that's where they live.
But at best, if you're gonna have anything modern, it's a sequel, it's not your beginning.
Yeah,
that's where you start.
Because, I mean, you know, Invisible Man came from that. Like, there's so much richness to it. Yes, it's going to be more expensive because you got to create the sets to do it, because obviously it's not the 1800s anymore. Yeah. But man, would that be stunning to watch.
They'd be great origin stories to start there and bring them forward, because they have been brought forward into modern times through literature well in many cases. Dean Koontz did a great job of bringing Frankenstein forward into modern times. Mm-hmm. And there's authors who brought the vampire myth forward into modern times, and they do it really well. Look at that literature and go, okay, well, how do we modernize these characters but still keep the heart of them? And that's what The Mummy obviously missed. That's what Hollow Man obviously missed.
Hollow Man missed a lot of stuff.
Yes.
Now so many classic properties from the 80s slasher era and these more classic Universal characters are being handed over to Blumhouse for development now. I'm less worried about it than, say, Platinum Dunes. But I'd say the Blumhouse stuff is pretty hit and miss most of the time. Yeah. The Conjuring universe has fetched them quite a bit of money, but ultimately I think there are more bad ones than good ones out of...
Yeah.
If you add up like Annabelle, Curse of La Llorona, and all those other ones, The Nun, I think there's more bad ones than good ones.
Well, we're talking about original properties where sometimes there's a lot bad, but like they take big swings, and I think they might have more reverence for what these things are.
Well, they have been taking their time creating movies with a much lower budget and filling those coffers, and now they have a little bit more money to put into production if they want to. But maybe that's what Universal's looking at, is like, hey, can you create something that's going to create a lot of money but not cost a lot of cash?
So, yeah. And
that's maybe that lack of confidence within your own properties that sometimes comes through to the audience as well.
There's that, yeah. And Blumhouse has got a reputation for letting their creators be creators. Sometimes they might need to step in a little bit more and say, you know what, we're not really happy with this. Is there something you can do with it? Mm-hmm. Right? Without saying, this is what we want.
But they generally take really big swings, which I really admire.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point with Universal, clearly the people in charge haven't got a clue what to do with these things anymore. So they're handing them off to somebody else, and hopefully they do. And it's unfortunate. Hey, we're in the room. We're right here, guys. We can help you out.
Yeah.
To me, it seems like it's really fucking obvious, but what do I know? Oh, well, hopefully they'll get those going again. I mean, I still love all that stuff, but to be honest, I haven't loved the Universal attempts since Bram Stoker's Dracula and Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein.
Yeah, and I don't think those are even Universal movies.
I'm not sure. I might be wrong on that. Hey, guys. If you like this one, if you want us to maybe compare the classic Dracula to the Bram Stoker Dracula, or Frankenstein to Frankenstein, the Kenneth Branagh one, we might do that. But you know, speak loudly.
We've done Mummy to Mummy.
Yeah, if you want us to do some more of these classic monster comparisons, let us know. You can do that in a ton of different places. You can do it at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion the Remake at gmail.com. And you can email us your comments, your corrections, your suggestions, whatever floats your boat. And we will take a look at that, and maybe we'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like we wouldn't if you asked us to.
Just ask nicely.
Yeah, but I keep wondering, like, the Dracula to Dracula. There's so many.
There are. That's why I think
we need specific.
Dracula would be a series of movies. I mean, I actually want to compare the original Dracula to the Spanish one, which was shooting basically one would shoot during the day, one would shoot it in the same sets at night. And they're so much, so different. Like, the Spanish Dracula, you're not going to compete with Bela Lugosi, but the filmmaking was so much better. Everybody thought like the camera was locked in one spot at the time, but no, that Spanish one's using cranes, and it's a much better,
more vibrant film.
It's a much more vibrant film with better cinematography and better iconography. So I'd like to do that, and that might turn into a series somewhere along the way. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe we'll do it on Patreon.
Ooh,
I have been thinking about launching Patreon for next year, and we can do maybe stuff like that.
Fang with Invasion of the Remake.
Yeah, send us your thoughts on that as well. If we launch a Patreon, what you would like to see as exclusive content there. All right. Tell your friends and family about the show. You can find us at a ton of different places, of course. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, Player FM, Blueberry, Radio Public, Radio.com, the app, and even
freaking YouTube.
So tell your friends and family and help them get their
earballs
on the show. Do us a favor. Make it happen. And, of course, this is just the second episode in all the horror that's happened all month long. We got three more, and then we still got our 31 Days of Horror episodes dropping in November, and we're guesting on a ton of different shows. Got a lot of, you know, short segments and guest appearances on full episodes. So
we're invading everywhere.
So we are in all the horror in a big way this year, and if you want to know where we're going to land next, you can only do that by following at AllTheHorror18 on Twitter, or looking for that hashtag AllTheHorror, and joining the Facebook group AllTheHorror as well, which they talk about horror all year long over there.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different podcasts dropping every day. If you want to know which ones they are, make sure you follow at AllTheHorror18 on Twitter, and you'll get the daily schedule of what's dropping which day. And it's podcasts and articles and all sorts of cool stuff. So
we got some written work coming out, and I'd heard a rumor that one of our writers has partnered up with an artist friend, so there could be something really cool happening there. Nice. I haven't seen what that's going to be or if it's even going to happen, but we're keeping our fingers crossed.
That's really cool.
Intriguing.
And if you're digging this, like, horror convention for your ears, like, this is a podcast horror convention for your ears, and if you want a souvenir that is for a good cause, they can get a t-shirt, Sam.
They can. If you go to tpublic.com/user/allthehorror, we have 6 different designs. You can purchase the shirt, the mug, the sticker, the pillows. There's anything you could possibly want from TeePublic, our logo's on. Actually, our designs are on because there's 6 of them. But any profit from those sales, it will be going to Scares That Care.
There you go. Help some kids in need.
Exactly.
So it's all for a good cause, cool, and there's some really cool designs. If you want some bleeding skulls, that is your place to go. It's for all your Halloween swag.
And don't forget creepy babies.
Creepy babies and skulls with horns. And it's a good old time over there.
Yep.
That's my wardrobe right there.
Oh, yeah. They have lovely shirts there, guys. Lovely shirts.
Yeah, 100% of that goes to Scares to Care, so make sure you get yourself a t-shirt and a souvenir from this unprecedented podcast event. All right, I've been Jason.
I am always Sam.
And I continue to be Trish.
And we are out of here.
Walked was thorny, through no fault of your own.
But as the rain enters the soil, the river enters the sea. So tears run to a predestined end. Your suffering is over. Now you will find peace for eternity.